things have been cruising along swimmingly. When I noted these awful, awful bursts of pain shooting up my right side of my abdomen, and sufficient that when we ended the program, I was drenched in sweat and feeling like, well, something, feeling just plumb, plain, awful. And having experienced that a number of occasions in the last 4 or 5 years, I immediately said, okay, well, I know what I'm going to be told with this. Well, Bob, you need to stop eating food and rest your gut and drink only water, and right? So I got on the Ibuprofen Express, and I drank only water, and the pain just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse until on Sunday, and this all goes into a larger story, so maybe I'd better, before I dive into it all, again, thank you for joining us this evening for the conversation, and let you know that I am going to try to get 3 hours of radio done this evening, but that it may prove difficult or impossible to do so because of the pain involved, which is in my gut. Although watching the various sundry forms of ignorance, broad spectrum stupidity, and generalized hatefulness that pervades the percentage of this country that makes up the right wing is enough to make anybody's gut sick. Mine is more particularized and localized. I will also offer this disclaimer and make sure that everyone has a vote in this and a say-so. Because there really is. There's an element of participatory democracy in this little conversation that's been going on for these many years now. I have been, since Sunday, on some humdinging, world-beating medications. They are the sort of thing that, could he have gotten into my room, Flush Flimball probably would have suffocated me with a pillow to get. Ah, give me that tube out of your arm, Kincaid. That's the good stuff. The Big M. I want it. And then again, at $50 million a year, maybe he's still sending his maid out with a cigar box full of cash and to come back with a cigar box full of street drugs. You can get away with a lot at $50 million. But I think the thing that, well, never mind. But anyway, you've got to vote in this, and if I start sounding like I'm doing drug-addled Limbaugh radio, feel free to just drop me a note, bobkincaid@gmail.com. That's bobkincaid@gmail.com. Bob, you're sounding a little drug-addled there.
Oh, that's sort of thing. Foster Brooks kind of, oh.
Right. Hopefully I won't. Hopefully I can keep my together for 3 hours and get a program out. I have not had pain medication since about 7 o'clock this morning. So understand that there's a certain reality that comes with that too. But I can't stand it when I'm away from this microphone. It drives me nuts. I thought they'd say, oh, you're going to shut up. But when I got checked into the hospital, I actually asked them on Monday morning if I could pretty please have the login for the wireless internet, and they actually obliged. And so there I sat Monday evening listening to Malloy, and I felt like one of the Who's in Whoville on top of that little puff of fluff, screaming, "I'm here! I'm here!" Only nobody could hear, and my tablet wouldn't let me into the Malloy chat room, and but it's probably just as well I didn't get in, because I would have probably, I don't know, started long digressions on the colors of the things that popped into my world periodically. Or, I don't know, maybe, you know, things being such as they are, I would have started hallucinating flying monkeys or any number of the right-wing freaks. So there you go. But I will try not, I will try earnestly not to sound like Limbaugh on a hopped out of his brains on pharmaceuticals, all ready for a all-boys weekend trip to the Dominican Republic. Who does he, when he does that, who does he leave in charge of taking care of the wife number whatever that it is that he keeps in the pit? It puts the lotion on its skin, or else it gets the hose again, my friend. I don't know. Not sure who I feel sorrier for, the woman in the pit or the little boy in the Dominican Republic. I don't know. But anyway, it's frustrating for me to be away from the microphone, and I apologize for my absence, but in a way, let's put it this way. It is one thing to do talk radio and talk about issues that one thinks are important to this country. It is another entirely to unwillingly become a part of those issues. Now, I certainly did not go off seeking to be a part of this issue, but as I made the decision to go to the emergency room on Sunday, it occurred to me that I, by God, had, because I am. Here's the setup. Ordinarily, perhaps I might have waited until Monday and just gone down to my local clinic and told them my symptoms, which were not the first occasion of my symptoms. Horrendous belly pain with particular locality that on four or five occasions in the last 4 years has been diagnosed as pancreatitis, and which they then hand me a handful of heavy-duty narcotics and tell me to go and eat no more. It's really the principal dieting method that I've used over the last 4 years. And so I go on clear liquids, and we work our way up to chicken broth and Jell-O and popsicles, and slowly but surely, and then a little bit later, it doesn't take long usually. Never does with the addict. I'm back out on the street hustling for macaroni and cheese and pulled pork. But the problem is, we don't have anybody in our clinic who can even write a prescription. We don't have anybody in our clinic who can say, "Okay, Bob, you know the drill. Go home, bed rest, go sleepy by, water only, remain hydrated, no food for about 2 weeks, buddy. It'll be great for you. You'll lose about 20, 30 pounds. And then slowly back into until we're talking about your macaroni and cheese problem again. Okay? Because our physician's assistant is gone. Our nurse practitioner bolted for another small community that's closer to her home. We never get to see a general practitioner, And so I knew that if I went there on Monday, what kind of a response I would get. Well, that's great for you, Bob, but you need to go on over to the emergency room because we ain't got nobody here. Because, see, if they'd had somebody in the doctor's office, I could have at least plunked down cash and paid for the appointment. You might recall I told you the story of Agnes's rear-ender car wreck back on the day before New Year's Eve of 2011. It was an absolutely sunny, beautiful, bluebird-perfect day, December the 30th, 2011, when my lovely wife, driving in my rusty red pickup truck, some 16 years old, with some 137,000 miles on it, was stopped at the intersection of our road, blinking to turn left, waiting for oncoming traffic to clear so she could do so, when one of the pillheads from our community plowed into the rear end of the truck at full speed, you know, at least 55 miles an hour, and without so much as touching his brake. God knows what would have happened to my darling wife and my beloved son had they not been in that 16-year-old giant piece of Mexican iron that came by way of Detroit. I told you the whole story about going to the emergency room with them and being there till 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was. And New Year's Eve, and go listen to the program if you want to. It's in the archives at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Well, the upshot of that was that a few weeks later, toward the end of January, I suppose, maybe early February. No, it was early well, I don't remember. End of January, early February. The insurance company settled up on the property damage of one 16-year-old rusty red pickup truck with some 136,000 miles on it. That made it possible. That, and believe you me, please, when I tell you that the sum of that settlement was no great shakes. It didn't allow me to go out and say, you know, buy that Maserati for which I have long yearned. No, it didn't even allow me to go out and try to purchase a truck of equal vintage. Sorry. What it did, however, do was to render me, you know, Bob, was to render me too wealthy. No, I'm not kidding. Too wealthy for Pofolk's health care coverage in the state of West Virginia. This is one of those brutal states, you might recall. I think there are 24 of them in the U.S., in which a single man with no job, no home, no assets whatsoever cannot qualify for Medicaid. The only reason I qualified for some level of Pofolk's coverage was because there was some sort of presumptive determination made that our teenage children were better off with a father who was alive instead of dead. For many, if not most, of the poor in this state, that determination is not made. They are deemed better off dead than having Pofolk's coverage. So that was, without a doubt, in the back of my mind when I finally looked at Agnes and kind of grimacing said, okay, let's go to the ER. This is going to be a $5,000 cash bill that I have no idea how we're going to pay, but I think we got to go. And so we did. And like I told you, I expected that that I knew how this thing would go, because for at least on at least four occasions, perhaps five, they all get kind of hazy and run together in a sort of opioid mix after a while. I'd had the same outcome every time, being treated like an ignorant, beer-swilling hillbilly, being told to not drink, even though I would look at them and say, I don't. The first time I looked at them and said, what, no apple juice, no cranberry juice, no grape juice, nothing, no water? And having had it explained to me that, no, I need to stop my evil ways. And that had been said to me every other time. And then I had been fired up with some intravenous fluids, a couple of bags of fluids, to make sure I was nicely rehydrated, because I always dehydrate in these circumstances. And then the kidneys start aching, and now, this is not going to be an hour of me talking about my personal aches and pains and woe is me. That's not the purpose. But I get sent home and told to stay in bed, mind my own business, let the world go by outside, catch up on some good reading or whatever. And let the pain, yeah, because one of the reasons for the pain meds is because it significantly blunts your appetite. And yet it does so without making you feel, you know, get that taller, smarter, faster, stronger, better looking feeling that stimulant anti-appetite drugs bring on. And that was what I was fully expecting to have happen when I registered, God knows, as a member of the vast millions of Americans who are uninsured in this country. I figured I would likely get perhaps less than that, that I would be handed an apple and a road map and best wishes, hail to the well met, and on down the road. That is not, however, what happened. I went in, they did the usual thing, you know, how much do you weigh? Weigh too much. What's your blood pressure? What's your temperature? And, you know, tell me where it hurts. And I did. And then something strange began to happen. The lab results began coming back. And lo and behold, there were there was my white count. Significantly, not dramatically, but significantly elevated. There was some numbers on my various enzyme panels, upper than one might hope to see up. And then the physician's apprentice or physician's assistant or magician's apprentice or I'm not sure what he was by that time, because the intravenous medication and its accompanying anti-nausea drug had kicked in. The anti-nausea drug, something like Zoolander or something, I don't remember. And the guy began pressing around on my belly, and then he did fun things like bending and contorting my leg and leaning over me as if he was trying to limber me up for the gymnastics final at the London Olympics. And then he slapped me on the bottom of my foot. Hey, Doc! And then he leaned over and pressed way in on the other side of my gut from where my appendix should be, because the other side of my gut from where my appendix should be is where my appendix actually is, and let go, and I went, "Whoo, Jesus!" That's what rebound pain feels like. And then I made a mistake. Where'd you learn a term like rebound pain? thing. I said, I didn't just fall off the turnip truck, Doc. I did have 4 years in college and 3 years in law school. Oh, no! And all the blood drained out of his face the minute he heard law school. I should have just said, because Agnes was trying to do it for me. I'm a nurse! He learned it from me! But the minute he heard law school, he got this look in his eye. He got this look in his eyes, like, "Oh dear me! It looks like we may have to get the red hot poker diagnostic set out. We've got one." Never mind the fact that I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on the radio. And then everything changed. And another doctor came in and did undignified things to me that I will not describe to you, except to say that I still feel undignified about it, because apparently that's another way of checking for appendicitis, even when one's appendix is on the wrong side of one's body. And they came in then and said, because by then they'd sent me off to the CT scanner to have another horrifying dose of radiation pumped into my body so that they could get another picture of things that they had at least a series of, you know, new from Time Life. Bob's insides. See the lack of change over time. But they wanted a fresh one. And in the meantime, the nurses came in and because I told them exactly where it hurt. And the minute I told them exactly where it hurt, they pushed in on that to make sure that it really did. Woo! And then another one would come in. Does it really hurt that? Woo, yeah! Hey, Charlie, is this the place? Poke. Ah! Ooh, that's an interesting place for him to have pain. I wonder if it would happen if we did it to him twice. Boom! Oh! But, like I said, then they did something they have never, ever done before when I have shown up there with Mapo Folks coverage. Because usually the part of the program where they walk in and say, "Sir, do you drink?" And I say, "No." And they say, "Well, you need to quit anyway. You, sir, have pancreatitis." And there you are with that beard and your white hair and looking like you live with the boys under the bridge and drink screw top wine. You've got pancreatitis is what you've got. And at which point they would send me home. At which point Agnes would become furious. We talked about what happens when Agnes gets furious on Friday night's program. You might recall it involves words like run. But we go home and I fall in love with things like water and instant chicken bouillon. Suddenly, with me, uninsured, on the hook to pay them cash money, not some agreed-upon rate from some insurance company or government bureaucracy, but real, live, hard, cold cash money, they walked in and said, "We want you to stay a while, Bob. Can you do that for us?" At which point I was grimacing and looked at them and said, "Mm-hmm, okay." And away we went. With visions of mounting numbers running through my brain and me thinking, how in the sweet name of Jesus am I ever going to pay for this? And because of the nature of what I do and what we talk about, wondering what it, you know, how many times, how many millions of times a day that same terrified question must run through some American's mind in this country. How are we going to take care of this? And I looked at Agnes and I said, how are we going to take care of this? And she said, shut up, Bob. You know, it's that tender, loving, warm, nurturing bedside manner that makes Agnes the magnificent woman she is, and must have certainly made her the truly dedicated, yes, stunning in the nurse's uniform nurse that she was. No, Lottie, I wasn't worried about the yummy hospital food because I knew I wasn't going to be seeing any, because at that point I had not had food since 4:30 Friday afternoon and had not had water since about 8 p.m. and had been begging all along. Water? No, not just yet. We might have to take you to surgery. And water? No, not just. We need to keep your belly empty, and we're giving you IV fluids. What, are you not grateful? Water? No, I don't think so. Sort of my mouth began to get heavy dry. I mean, because I feel a little bit like getting in the column. And away we went down the hall, and I answered a series of medical history questions, that for all I knew, the wrong answer to which would be accompanied by waterboarding. And listened as they said, all right, we're going to bring you some morphine now for your IV drip. And a little bit of a little bit more Zoolander to keep down the nausea. And we're going to give you a bag of what's it called? Rocephin, just in case, you know, just to cut down on whatever that nasty infection was. By this time, they were telling me I had a UTI, and I'm like, how? And I've got Frank Zappa in the playing in the back of my mind on the little MP3 player in my brain, singing, "Why does it hurt when I pee?" And you know, I think I got it from a toilet seat. Really, a UTI? What? And interestingly, Agnes was still there when they were hanging the Rocephin and everything. I would find out later that they had not charted that they had given me the Rocephin, but the order for it was still in the chart, but nothing noting that they had actually delivered it to me. That kind of thing leads to, overdoses. And so Agnes, in a state of pure unmitigated exhaustion, finally, at my insistence, went home. And I fitfully tried to sleep. Not with much luck. Because every time I would successfully doze off, and I absolutely refused to put on that groovy hospital gown, I laid there in my khaki trousers and my button-down shirt, because I felt like as long as I didn't look the part, I wasn't really in the hospital, because I've successfully avoided being in the hospital in large part for most of my life, though with the exception of a trip there against my own will when I was 3 or 4 years old, at which point they removed my tonsils. I still remember it vividly. And so I would doze off, begin to have some bizarre-ass the Samuel Taylor Coleridge-esque opium dream. Vivid. The full function Technicolor. Nothing makes sense. Salvador Dali ain't got nothing on the dreams I was having. And then somebody else said, Bob, excuse me. I need to take your temperature and your blood pressure. Bob, excuse me. And, you know, as soon as they got done, nod back out. 2 minutes later, I need to check your blood sugar. Bob, I have a patient quality survey for you. Bob. And so finally, I just sort of opened my eyes and by force of will pulled the lids back and sat there staring at the wall with you know, some Willie Nelson song playing in the background of my mind. And feeling progressively worse. And telling them early in the morning, folks, I take a blood pressure pill every day. And not getting it. So that somewhere around 3 o'clock on Monday afternoon, they took my blood pressure and said, well, would you look at this? It's 150 over 110. Whatever could possibly cause that? How about not getting my blood pressure medicine? No, Lottie, they didn't wake me for a sleeping pill. They woke me to tell me that they were adding more stuff to my IV, which they could actually have done, and I never would have noticed it. But, no, the hospital is no place to get any rest. And so, with my blood pressure somewhere around 150 over 110, they finally decided late on Monday that I could have what they referred to as sips of water. It was earlier on Monday that little old uninsured me had a conversation with the surgeon that had been consulted on this, which was the whole reason that I had been admitted in the first place. Who said, you know, I'd really like to have an MRCP or MRPC, MRCP. I said, well, great, doctor. I hope you get one. Is that is it Italian, German? I favor German sports cars. Who knows? And he explained to me that it was a very specific MRI of the little ductal area between the liver and the gallbladder. And the stomach and the pancreas and so forth. And I said, oh, well, maybe it doesn't matter if it's Italian or German. But maybe you'll be getting one after all.
You're as beautiful inside as you are out, Bob.
See, that's what makes her a beautiful and incredibly hot redheaded nurse. And
you know I'm checking up on you, right?
As long as you don't check me like they did in the emergency room. Well, no, I don't know. I'll let you. I got no shame left.
See, that's why I love you.
I had some little student back there watching that when it happened. I was like, better leave, please! And anyway, so they did that test, and they and I'm thinking, if a regular MRI is a couple of $1,000, this one that has the funny-looking... the belly plate that goes over, it's probably six. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to say welcome to Walmart for a long time to pay this one off. And anyway, the doc by then later had sat down and said, show me again where it hurts, which I really appreciated because he didn't reach over to press the, you know, press the, make Bob's nose light up button. Woo! Instead, he let me do it for him. And I said, well, let's see, if you come down here to my sternum, there's my sternum, and come down here past that pointy solar plexus place that's the rubbery part of a chicken breast, and you put about four fingers there, and I pressed in and went, ha! And I said, and then you start walking that over to my right, like, ha, 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 ha. He said, that's where it is, huh? Yeah. And a floor doc had come over and done the same thing to me. And then he just reached under me like he was going to, fireman's carry me right off the bed or something. And he just reaches under me and pulls up and said, that doesn't hurt. I said, not like the rest of it does. I mean, it's annoying as hell. I wish you would have asked first, but no. He says. Says I. He says, you know, your pancreas lays really, really deep inside your body. I said, even if your insides are backwards? He said, well, that's just your colon. It's not all of your insides. Everything else is where it's supposed to be. I said, okay. He said, your pancreas lays way deep inside, and if you had pancreatitis, when I did that, you'd have been on the ceiling calling me names. I said, well, you know, just wait a minute. Poke around a little bit more, and I can oblige you on the name calling. Yeah, I was thinking about the same thing, Lottie, in the chat room. Head on radionetwork.com/chatroom, by the way. It's free and it's easy. Lovely community of folks who real-time conversational aid in electronic print during the program. Lottie is one of our chat room moderators, and he said, you're lucky it wasn't a teaching hospital, or you would have had a line of students pressing on it to see where it hurts. Yeah, they sent a student nurse or something in who was there to assess my vitals, and I just said, oh, hell with it, do it. By that point, my dignity was in tatters. And so the one doc had told me about how deep my pancreas was, and this other doc, who was a surgeon, said, you know, that's in all the wrong places to really be full on pancreatitis. And I said, well, whatever could it be, doctor? He said, I think it's your gallbladder, personally. I said, well, bless my soul. Because, see, 4 years ago, Dr. Agnes had said, because she was furious, Bob, I'm pretty sure it's your gallbladder, honey. So Dr. Agnes was confirmed. And that's basically the whole story. Monday evening, I actually got a tray of so-called clear liquids. This featured a styrofoam cup of sugar-free green Jell-O, a sugar-free popsicle of some sort, a can of ginger ale, and two things of juice, a cup of hot water, and an envelope of bouillon. Yeah, this doesn't sound like food porn, does it? No, me neither. A bag of quite possibly the worst decaf, Gary, it was a decaffeinated orange pekoe, cut orange pekoe, and cut black tea with what tasted like must have been nail clippings in it for flavor. I ate the Jell-O, I ate the popsicle. I didn't touch the pop. I read the ingredient labels of the juice to make sure it was 100% juice or that it contained no high fructose corn syrup. I've been rather persnickety about not tormenting my pancreas with that poisonous garbage. And they came, took that away, but they were allowing me to have water, so I was making the best of a bad situation. And I got to listen to Malloy, and it was the whole Horton Hears a Who thing. I'm here. I'm here. And tried to doze off again. And I found out another thing, because I had never had morphine before. Suddenly I had Jefferson Airplane's White Rabbit playing in the background of my mind, you know, with that little snare drum going and the sort of reverby, what sounds like probably a semi hollow bodied electric guitar. And Grace Slick's voice going in the back of my mind. But I found out that it has a hangover. And quite frankly, I don't ever want it again. Because I don't usually get headaches. But my God, what a headache I got. And it was with me until about 9 o'clock this morning. Just a thunderous headache that made it felt like there was some sort of little demonic Keebler elf behind my right eye that was just trying to push the eyeball right out of its socket and kicking me in the head when he wasn't successful. But that's mostly the story. By about 11 o'clock yesterday morning, they had turned me loose. And by the way, let me take this moment. I was able to tweet a little bit along the way and Facebook some. And lots and lots and lots of kind good wishes came in on my Twitter and Facebook accounts. And I want to thank everybody for that. This being prayer meeting Wednesday, you thought I'd forgotten, didn't you? Well, I mean, yeah, come on, the narcotic haze is not that thick. How long have we been doing prayer meeting Wednesday, right? Right. Yeah. But it reminded me of that business in the book of Matthew, chapter 25, that no one in there with their right-wing fundy Bibles seems to remember. That says, "Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungered, and ye gave me meat." Well, he didn't do that. "I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink." Well, not that either. "I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me." Well, for obvious reasons, I couldn't have anything to eat or drink. I guess I was pretty strange when I showed up at the desk there. More importantly, I was sick, and y'all visited. You put the internet to quite possibly its best possible use in helping to alleviate the fear and suffering and misery of a lone individual. And it really is important. See, that's not a magic zombie talking. That's a human being who has a profound and deeper understanding of the human condition than many of those around him did at that time. You know, it continues, "Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered and fed thee? Or thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto thee?" The king shall answer and say unto them, "Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you've done it unto one of the least of these my brethren," and I was feeling pretty damn least, thank you very much, "you've done it unto me. Then shall he say also unto them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was an hungered, and you gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you took me not in. Naked, and you clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and you visited me not. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, or a thirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? And then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. And these shall go away into under everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. Even if you don't buy into the rest of the magic hoodoo zombie stuff, that makes pretty doggone good sense, doesn't it? Truly. And I was reminded. I was reminded by you, who so kindly, so sweetly, so nicely just said, Get well, Bob. An email in here. Cindy noting insurance money for your wreck is not taxable income. No, it's not taxable income, but it is an asset. Okay? In the brutal world of insurance, and in the case of the sort of half-hearted attempt at universal insurance for the poor that is Medicaid, it is countable as an asset. That is why a person who has no job and no assets can still not get Medicaid in this state. And I don't. And neither do the boys under the bridge. And that's just the brutal reality. My dear friend Holly, on one of my Facebook comments, said, "Oh, that's right. You live in the largest developed country in the world that doesn't take care of its people when they're sick." Yeah, really. Sort of calls that whole notion of civilized into question, as I noted in that exchange. But first and foremost is to thank you all for all of that. Second is to note that, you know, we've got that verse there about the lake of eternal fire that is reserved for the devil and all his angels. You'd think that a country that insists, whose right wing, evangelical right wing, insists that this here is a Christian nation founded on Christian principles. Well, by golly, if the country was founded on Christian principles, well, wasn't that Matthew 25 business Christian principles? If you've done it unto the least of one of these, my brothers, you've done it also unto me. If you've not done it unto one of the least of these, my brothers, you've not done it unto me. I mean, it doesn't get much more Christian principle-y than that now, does it? No, I don't think so. So theoretically, you could answer all of these right-wingers, well, you know, and there was one of them the other day, he's running for Senate in Arizona against Jeff Flake, who is running for the seat being vacated by the incredibly freakish John Kyle, who said, insurance is a privilege that you own. Earn. Insurance is a privilege that you earn. You mean just like salvation? That Calvinism stings when it hits you real sharp-like. But yeah. Yeah, that guy's a real goober. Of course, we've got some fine, upstanding Christians on the Supreme Court of the United States of America. And, you know, we call them the rats, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia. Every last one of them, a good, good Christian. Some of them so good that they're Opus Dei and may walk around with little pieces of barbed wire wrapped around their leg because it hurts real good and Jesus-y. And yet they sat there. You don't want to read. You don't want. You don't expect us to read all 2,400 pages about these disgusting sick people, do you? Now, Jesus does, but we don't. Wouldn't you love for that comment to have been offered to fat Tony D'Elia, whose daddy was a lead principal supporter of Mussolini in the United States? Now, we don't expect you to, Mr. Justice Scalia, but Jesus would. Yeah, how's that feel underneath that hair shirt, Mr. Justice? This is a brutal country. This is a scary country. And just for something now, I'll grant you, I had a little board that was right in front of my eyes that said, today is, and the weather is. By the way, did I mention I got up Monday morning and it was effing snowing? Yeah. Big, along about 4 o'clock in the morning on Monday, what had been a soaking sideways drizzle with temperatures persistently falling turned into snow that was wet, heavy snow that landed on branches that already had leaves on them and sent them across roads and just pulled down power lines and all kinds of fun stuff. Which led me to look out the window and just begin using all the fun words. Because I've been waiting for it to happen. I told you, as sure as God makes little green apples, and if you eat too much of them, you'll get a bellyache. It would happen right after all the diligent and good gardeners got their tomatoes out. Then the God of irony would just poke them with the little finger and go, you're going to buy all them plants all over again, sucker. Right. We never planted. The old timers always said you never plant your garden in the state of West Virginia until Memorial Day. Which seems such a waste of some very nice weather that could come along. That you get to a couple of days. Because, you know, all that came along, landed on the garden plants, killed all the garden plants, and then it was gone by noon, and the temperature was approaching something around 70. That was a sneeze you didn't want to hear. But this is a frightening country that is willing to let people far more ill than I simply suffer and die. And the people principally responsible for doing that call themselves Christians and talk about how health care ain't no right and talk about how the free market is the best solution. I've got to find me a free market solution here sooner rather than later for getting me, and this is such a great big word, a cholecystectomy. It means a gallbladder removal. Laparoscopic, preferably, where they blow you up like a balloon and they go in and snip it out and pull it out through a hole and you can never wear a Speedo at the beach again because you got all kinds of little tiny scars over your abdomen. Not that I was planning on wearing a Speedo at the beach, mind you. But if that's going to happen, well, you know, Jesus saves. All others pay cash. And so I don't know if it's a matter of, you know, they'll take payments from me, my heir, the signs forever at $10 a month or what. But everybody I've talked to said, oh, Bob, when that nasty little thing comes out of your body, you're going to feel so much better. But yes, in the course of the conversation with the surgeon there, I said, you know, this has been driving me crazy because I'm trying to figure out what I did to bring this on myself. Because I really did. No matter how much I keep continuing to try to recover, that old Calvinist urge is out there to try to figure out what sin I committed that the great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky decided to punish me for. And the only thing I could come up with, really, was that while I was in Washington, D.C. last week, on two occasions, in the Dirksen Senate Office Building cafeteria, I had availed myself of the macaroni and cheese and the pulled pork with barbecue sauce on the pulled pork, not the macaroni and cheese, and hot sauce on both. And the greens, the collard greens, you know, with little slivers of onions braised in, cubes of tomatoes that were heavenly. As the hunger really began to kick in, I began to absolutely freak out for some of that good, cheap Mexican restaurant salsa. I think I would have just... And it was funny when my labs came back, because lo and behold, there it was. Sodium, low. Yeah, me, Bob Kincaid, Mr. Cholesterol, but I've got low sodium. And so that was why my body was saying, you know, we'd like some salsa, Bob. Nah, we don't care what the little gallbladder bastard thinks. We want some salsa. It's way up on the list for when I get past popsicles and chicken broth. Mexican restaurant salsa. With no high fructose corn syrup, thank you very much, or no corn maltodextrin, if you please. My head writer David in Tennessee caught the Speedo reference. Speedo? Really, Bob? You or I in a Speedo? I can hear the smart-ass kid out at the beach now. Hey, Mommy, when does the balloon go up? Yeah, the really white, pale balloon. Yeah, Marty, I guess so. In other words, your sin was gluttony. And the great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky said, oh, well, you know, we've got all kinds of evil people in the world, murdering children and stuff, but I'm going to take a little time out here to work over the fat pale man there down in West Virginia. But then, and this kind of blew me away, then the surgeon also explained to me and said, well, Bob, I should probably tell you this. Greens can irritate the gallbladder. What? Yeah, greens. And of all the things that I'm willing to tolerate in my world, that almost seemed the most heretical. Greens are everything that is good for a human being in this world. Little punk-ass gallbladder in my... I'm irritated. It's like having... You know, a gallbladder is like having your very own personal Republican inside your body. Everybody else is getting along, trying to do their best, trying to get through the world... Trying to have a decent existence, maybe get a giggle once in a while, and the gallbladder's sitting over there tucked in. I'm irritated. That's what it is. The gallbladder is the Republican in your body. And when you get rid of it, you feel so much better. Right? Yeah. So ultimately the upshot for me is that sometime next week, before I go back on the road, and this is another part of me being really good to my belly, I have to get on the road next week. On May the 4th, I'm a flying to Boston. And I'm going to be there for a couple of events raising a ruckus about Bank of America. Subsidizing and financing mountaintop removal, the poisons from which contribute to the degradation of any number of internal bodily organs in Appalachia. And then I'm going to go to Charlotte and offer up a statement inside the Bank of America shareholders meeting along the same effects. And that's the 4th through the 9th of May, so I've got to be really good and get really well. So there's that. But sometime between now and then, I have to go over to the surgeon's office and sit down and have a conversation about when we can schedule this cholecystectomy. I've gotten to where I can say that almost professionally. And how in God's name I'm going to pay for it. I mean, pint of blood. I mean, would they like me to contribute toward somebody having children? Yeah, and I use a plastic cup. I don't have to be down to see anybody, because I don't have much more to give. But yeah, that's got to happen. So I got up this morning, and knowing that I was going to do everything in my power to be on the air, I started looking at stories, and of course, what you've just heard for the last 61 minutes has been more or less brewing inside my brain for, two or three drug-addled days now. Now this is just a check-in. Am I having any Limbaugh problems? I just want to make sure. Because way back when this program first went on the air, I promised the audience collectively that I would never submit them to Limbaugh Radio. And that promise persists. So, I'm not getting Limboy, am I? Let me know if I do, and I'll get right on it. But I got up this morning, you know, with that in my mind, and fresh in my mind the memory of having been in Washington, D.C. for the arguments regarding the Affordable Care Act and seeing all those weird little teabag freaky creeps, including that woman who claimed to be a physician, who said, that Obamacare, you won't be able to, Obamacare will send doctors to prison for ordering a prostate-specific antigen test or getting your granny a mammogram, it's death panels, Obamacare, and I just looked at it and said, why don't you quit lying? But that was in my mind. And I'm a fairly, it appears, mild case out of all of this. But it is worrying me to damn death. Because the minute you become a hospital patient, everything flies in front of your eyes. You know, it's like, no, Jesus, I got to get home now. And that's the first thing you start thinking, and you begin fretting and worrying more than you were when you went in the ER, even maybe. I got to get home. I got to survive this. You know, like I said, that little board was in front of me. It said, you know, today's date is, the weather is, the nurses are. And then it said, my goal today is. And I made sure I told everybody who came in the room. I said, you know, right over there where it says, my goal today is, they said, what's your goal? I said, not dying. And we ought not have a healthcare system in which that is a principal fear. Because, see, that's the thing. Even had I died, which I someday will, all of us will. Mr. Hank Williams Sr., having noted that no one here gets out alive. But when you die in a hospital, they still come after you for their profit. And they've got actual corporations who are
purposed on this planet solely to make sure that they get their what they deem to be their fair share of profit out of your hide, dead or alive. And that story was brought home to me in stunning reality, as if in some perfectly ordered way, as if it was just planned like this, this morning. There it was in the New York Times, a headline that read, "Debt collector is faulted for tough tactics in hospitals." It concerns a publicly traded corporation, which means that various and sundry anonymous shareholders make profits by investing in the business that this company does. It has to do with a company called Accretive Health. Now, I don't know about you, but Accretive Health just sounds icky. I had to look up accretive. Accretive means bringing together things that are normally not together. I thought it had something to do with, the way an oyster makes a pearl. But in this case, apparently, it is the growing together of human misery with the capitalist profit motive, which is certainly two things that should never go together. It's a story about how Accretive Health has been busted, stone cold busted, by the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota. Because Accretive Health is actually nothing more than a sick, sorry, sleazy, slippery, dirty, filthy, rotten, revolting collection agency. The only point being of Accretive Health, however, being that their job is twisting the collection thumbscrews on people who are in agony. The New York Times story, based upon the Minnesota Attorney General lawsuit, accounted how Accretive Health agents had been embedded at hospitals in Minnesota in which patients and family members are never told that they are debt collectors. And their job is to try to squeeze money out of people at the most fragile and dangerous times of their life. They are embedded as employees in emergency rooms. They demand that patients pay money before they're given treatment.
Well, dang it. This is the finest healthcare system in the world. Ain't nobody goes to an emergency room, don't get seen.
The Attorney General released hundreds of company documents that showed one after another, plain as day, what Accretive Health was doing to Minnesotans. And it's doing it to other people, too, because one of the fascinating things about this story is it has a buried lead. At the very end of the story is a buried lead. Yeah, I'll go ahead and tell you what that buried lead is. The end of the New York Times story says, last Tuesday afternoon, Accretive announced it won a contract to provide, quote, revenue cycle operations for Catholic Health East, which has hospitals in 11 states. So, to recap, Catholic Hospitals East has an absolute shit hemorrhage hissy if somebody wants contraception, but they're more than happy to provide you with your very own debt-collecting kneecapper right there in the emergency room.
And what was that line about a lake of eternal fire prepared for the devil and all his angels?
Why, yes, Catholic Hospital Health East, that's you he was talking about, your zombie god. That was you. You're the ones going into the lake of eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels because you're working on their side, sunshine.
But that wasn't the meat and potatoes of the story. The meat and potatoes of the story was that this thing, this program by Accretive Health was wildly pervasive inside Minnesota hospitals and arguably likely to be in other hospitals that have contracted with it in other states as well. Some of these embedded psychopaths are taught to demand that people pay outstanding bills first before being seen, or barring that, to discourage people from seeking emergency care at all. The people embedded by Accretive Health, you know, with the connivance of the hospitals, were even given access to the supposedly extremely private health information of patients. You know, a violation of federal law. Lori Swanson is the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota. She noted that another problem Accretive had was not openly identifying themselves as debt collectors. Depending on where you live in the country, you may want to jot this down. Accretive Health has contracts with Henry Ford Health System in Michigan, Intermountain Health Care in Utah, as well as several other states. They are headquartered in Illinois. Take that into account as well. Ms. Swanson said, I have every reason to believe that what they are doing in Minnesota is simply company practice. It's just business. Tell Michael I always liked him. It was only business. So naturally, the New York Times got on the blower and called up Accretive Health for their comment on this story. And an Accretive Health spokescreep. See, this is one of the problems that accompanies capitalism, because people get jobs doing loathsome things to their other fellow countrymen. There are people who get up and go to work every day for Accretive Health, and they think, my, oh my, I'm taking care of my family. And they just somehow or another compartmentalize the fact that they're taking care of their family by tormenting someone else's. So this spokescreep at Accretive Health, whose name is apparently not divulged, said, we have a great track record of helping hospitals enhance their quality of care. Really? What does strong-arming a suffering individual in the emergency room have to do with enhancing quality of care? I would think that that would directly diminish quality of care. Now, wouldn't you? The drive, and all this happens because of the drive to suck money out of the
daily failing, profit-driven, capitalist-oriented healthcare system in this country. It is no longer enough to torment people once they leave the hospital. Now it has become necessary to torment them while they're there and before they've even been seen. You know, I mean, consider this. You know, when you sit down and you register in a hospital, say at the emergency room, you're on the clock, sweetheart. You really are. You're the ticker, you know, the machine's, yeah, it's running, rolling, baby. And so while they're on your dime, they're sending a collection agent to ride your ass. Man, that is one beautiful scam. Let's torment the rubes and make them pay us to do it. Why do I describe this as a failing, if not already failed, profit-driven healthcare system? The article in the New York Times notes that more than 5,000 community hospitals provided $39.3 billion in uncompensated care last year in 2010, up 16% from 2007. Accretive Health, by the way, like I said, they're publicly traded. That means that anonymous the portfolio managers and mutual fund managers buy and sell their shares in an effort to make money for their clients. And Accretive Health had $29.2 million in profits in 2011. That was a 130% increase from the previous year. The phrase they use at Accretive is achieving payment through what they call revenue cycle operations. Gee, and I thought they just did surgical operations in the hospital, but now they're allowing these walking bundles of filth to do revenue cycle operations. In the Minnesota case, there were daily meetings at the hospitals of the Accretive spies. And Accretive embed spies with high collection tallies were rewarded with gift cards, you know, not even real money. Those who fell behind were threatened with termination. Anyone who's ever seen Glengarry Glen Ross understands the principle behind that. It was September 2010 when an Accretive staffer wrote, "We've started firing people that aren't getting with the program." Here's where it starts getting infuriating, the New York Times story. Collection activities extended from obstetrics to the emergency room. In July 2010, an Accretive manager told staff members at Fairview Hospital that they should, quote, get cracking on labor and delivery since there is, quote, a good chunk to be collected there, or as the prophet Bill Hicks, peace be upon him, might note, that's a good dollar. Reading directly from the article again, employees were told to stall patients entering the emergency room. Did you get that? Stall patients entering the emergency room. You're entering the emergency room because you are in a no-shit emergency. But to stall them with life itself on the line, to stall them in hopes of getting them to agree to pay a previous balance as their life ebbs away. Employees of Accretive In the emergency room, for example, we're told to ask incoming patients first for a credit card payment. Could you make a credit card payment? If that failed, the employees were told to say, well, if you have your checkbook in your car, I'll be happy to wait for you. Because, see, I'm a nasty person. I espouse nonviolence. I believe in nonviolence. But in those circumstances, like the way I was feeling Sunday night, and I was not subjected to any of this. I want to be very, very fair to the hospital. They didn't give me any grief. They said, you're registered, and we'll call you as soon as we can get to you. It's very busy tonight, sir. And in a state as desperate as West Virginia, busy indeed it was. But if somebody like that sat down next to me in the emergency room and said, I'll be happy to wait for you while you go to your car and get your checkbook, I'd say, no, you come with me to my car because I don't have my checkbook out there, but I do have a ball bat, and I'm going to destroy your goddamn kneecaps, you profiteering son of a bitch. Because you're screwing with me while I may be losing my life, and I have no mercy whatsoever for yours. The New York Times story contains the account of Marcia Newton, who has a son named Max, who needed ear tube surgery in November. She had been one of those blessed stay-at-home mothers in Corcoran, Minnesota, that Ann Romney is so fond of. Although she also says she loves it. Did you catch this? She loves it that there are mothers out there who can't stay at home with their children, but instead have to go out into the workplace. She said she loves that. Maybe she could have added, as George Bush did in Minnesota, that it was uniquely American to have two or three jobs and still not be able to make ends meet. Oh, Ann Romney, you're just a darling. Marcia Newton went to the hospital in November for her son Max's ear tube surgery. She had never been asked to pay for care before receiving it. She said they were really aggressive about getting that money up front. And then she found out that these so-called hospital employees were really embedded spy debt collectors. And she said, you really feel hoodwinked. One hospital employee told Ms. Swanson, the Attorney General of Minnesota, patients are harassed mercilessly. They maintained something, a creative did, maintained something called a stop list. They were shadowed, these people on the stop list. They were shadowed by accretive worms. To keep them from seeking treatment. In March 2011, doctors at Fairview Hospital in Minnesota complained that the strong-arm tactics of accretive were discouraging patients from seeking life-saving treatments. The accretive official said that the doctors' complaints were country club talk. It remains to be seen whether the Barack Obama administration, and in particular his Attorney General Eric Holder, will empower some U.S. attorney for the district of wherever to tell these stories to a grand jury and pursue indictments. A few words, if you don't mind, if I have not already over-filibobstered my welcome. a few words now about accretive health care. As David in Tennessee notes, there's a little bit of justice involved here. Once the story broke, the accretive health stock plunged 40-plus percent. Yeah, oopsie, investors no likey. It needs to plunge some more. And yeah, David, I'm not sure that it isn't excretia health care. They do, he notes, behave rather shittily, don't they? Just asking. Hear, hear. No, stories like this send me off and running down the rabbit hole of trying to find out. You know, when you read about a company that is that slimy, you want to find out how it got to be that slimy. So, hey, it's 2012. They've got a big old self-congratulatory website. They say, for instance, Accretive does, that they have a passion for their clients. Let's listen in. Do tell. Don't be shy.
So, here we are today, and I'm really happy. This is a treat to have Mary here. I have known Mary for, 10, 15 years. I knew her when she was at Accenture. I have known her since she started Accretive. I've been on the board of Accretive, so I've seen the Accretive story. And I guess, you know, the first question, since you probably or may not know what Accretive does, is, you know, what does Accretive do?
Accretive has two primary business lines. The first is to actually help not-for-profit, all providers, but the vast majority of them are not-for-profit, hospitals and large physician practice groups get all the revenue that was really due them in the first place. And that's a very enormous and complex process. It's end-to-end, so it starts with the time that the episode of care is being scheduled all the way through to cash.
You know, it's end-to-end. It starts with the little babies being born in the OB department, and it ends with people clutching their guts in abject misery, thinking maybe they're dying in the emergency department. Yes, it's end to end. That's one of those business school terms that the 1% like to throw around.
And we can more than double a hospital's operating margin. The second major piece of the business, actually, we just signed our inaugural deal in this innovative area, but we are...
By the way, I should tell you, Mary is Mary Tolan. She's a very clippy speaking bleach blonde predator who, in talking about getting the hospitals all they deserve, is willing to, within the freight of that statement, make clear that she's into making sure that the people who are actually suffering don't get what they deserve, which is the value of their billing. Or, shall we say, life-saving treatments desperately needed. You know, because it's much easier to file a claim against an estate, after all, isn't it?
We are helping healthcare providers actually become accountable care entities and being able to take on the responsibility for the health of populations and the cost of that care. And so we just signed this deal, and we're really helping every aspect of people, process, and technology to put providers in position to really change the game on delivering care quality and costs.
Right. By putting, in position, in putting people in position, that means putting verminous, little, squirmy, crawly, vile, hateful debt collectors in emergency rooms to make sure that people on the stop list don't try to get care for that screwed up gallbladder or that rotting pancreas or maybe keep them from getting that cancer diagnosed until it's metastasized past the ability of any medical science to treat it. You know, putting people in place. Like in graves.
I was surprised at the degree to which I would really develop an affection for not-for-profit executives. It's interesting. Like,
oh, did you hear the host just chuckling? Oh, the affection I would develop for not-for-profit executives. No, Mary Tolan, the affection you developed was for the money that not-for-profit executives had the ability to bring your way. Right?
They're your customers.
Yeah, they're my customers. And, you know, you think about the not-for-profit space as maybe being a little complacent and so forth. And what I learned is that they're incredibly dedicated people who are very mission-oriented and mission-centric. And
those are fun little phrases you learn in the MBA world. Mission-centric. Makes it sound like they're flying to the freaking moon, doesn't it? Mission-centric.
They're very easy to work for. I mean, you really respect what they do and the way they look at things. They're very focused on the clinical side of things, as they should be. But when you get a chance to do something really important for them on...
You know, like putting verminous spies in ER and OB departments who can twist people's lives around their fingers while they are in moments of profound extremis. You know, that kind of thing.
On the side of the business that's the business side that can really get them more outcomes, it's really fun. And they really...
Fun. You get that? It's fun. This is the CEO of Accretive Health describing as fun the ability to torture people who are in agony. This is the for-profit model of healthcare. I don't care if she's talking about nonprofits or not. Because this, she is damn sure not a not-for-profit. She is for-profit all the way. And it's fun when people suffer. It's fun to put the screws to them until they weep at the mere thought of having to go to the hospital and face one of those stalkers who have a stop list in their hand. It's fun.
They really appreciate what we do. What actually has not been tried before, and what we are working on directly right now, is empowering the physicians who are the expert decision makers in this.
Oh, wait, they're empowering physicians. Oh, my God. What are they? Are they passing them a needed diagnostic tool? Are they handing them that funny little rubber-headed tomahawk thingy that they check your reflexes with? They're empowering physicians. No, I don't think so.
Market to actually have incentives and all the information and the operating structure to really integrate the care for the sickest people.
Yeah, what that means is they look at the doctors and say, listen, thumb fingers, you like that country club membership, don't you? You like those vacations you take, those golf vacations in the Caribbean, don't you? Well, stop with the damn country club talk while we squeeze some money out of these deadbeats that come in into this not-for-profit hospital looking for you to actually pretend that you give a damn about them. Get out of the way and let us get to work on our profits, Doc, okay? International listeners to the horn, are you hearing this? Is this just shocking to you? This is the reality of America. This is America, the America where everything, including the agony of the suffering, are deemed a portion of the profit motive of a so-called free market that feeds on human flesh. We take children into whatever little bit of history they have, and we teach them, for instance, about the Mexica people. You know, one of my favorite cultural studies. You know, the Valley of Mexico, 500 years ago, wiped out by Cortez, that bunch. And we say, you know what, as if to sort of say they had it coming, they earned it. Well, they did human sacrifice. They carried people up to the top of the pyramid, and they just cut their hearts out and fed them to their filthy, filthy little gods. It wasn't that awful?
What's the difference between them and Mary Tolan?
Wouldn't you love to find the parents of Mary Tolan and look at them and say, what did you do to make this individual so ungodly evil?
We'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Fee-for-service medicine has actually been causing us on the margins to consume our delivery system in a very suboptimal way.
Now, this woman is a one percenter, yet she refers to herself as us on the margins. Sister, you wouldn't know the margins if they came up and begged you for spare change. Us on the margins.
I was only able to buy one Couturier-designed suit this week. I'm living life on the margin. I've only been to the Caribbean once in the last year. I don't know if I can take it, this life on the margins.
Only society that actually pays providers to do things. We shouldn't be surprised that we do more. What a physician doesn't have today is, let's say, a primary care physician that might have 1,100 to 2,500 patients on their patient panel. They don't really have the full line of sight to all the data on those patients.
But you do, don't you, Mary?
All that data resides over with the payers today. And they really don't have any incentives to try to hone in on who are the 100 patients within that patient panel that are going to really drive all the population costs next year. And that's exactly what we're doing. We have the algorithm.
Because those people need to die. And Mary Tolan, oh, what, Mary Tolan? You've got the algorithms? Oh, good for you.
Algorithms that will predict which of the 1,100 patients, which 100 we should really focus on so that a physician doesn't have to be reactive.
You mean you've got a computer death panel, Mary?
Why, yes, you do. I can't stand any more of this vile, filthy, and disgusting woman. You might want to know that the mission and values of Accretive Health is that they have a laser focus on excellence. Accretive Health's mission: to strengthen the financial stability of healthcare providers through excellence. Wait a minute, I think we've got the wrong voice for that. To strengthen the financial stability of healthcare providers through excellence. Best people and leading technology, thereby increasing healthcare access for all. You know, especially the verminous, creepy, crawly, blood-sucking little healthcare espionage agents that they embed deep into the bowels of not-for-profit hospitals. Now, let's talk a minute about Mary Tolan. Prior to assuming her current role, Tolan was a leading partner at Accenture, the $16 billion global management consulting technology service and outsourcing company. She was the group chief executive of a $2.3 billion global operating group. Back in 2010 maybe? She was named a distinguished alumni of the University of... Oh, wait a minute. It all makes sense now, doesn't it? Maybe it wasn't 2010, but she's been named a distinguished alumnus of the... Alumna of the... Because they've got it wrong here. A distinguished alumni. She was named a distinguished alumni. Alumni is plural. It's actually alumni, A-L-U-M-N-I. She would be a distinguished alumna of the University of Chicago. That sick pile of bricks temple to the psychopathic hatreds and misanthropies of Milton Friedman. She also received Ernst & Young's Entrepreneur of the Year Award, and she was a member of Crain's Top 40 Under 40. Why, she serves on the council for the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago and on the Board of Trustees for the University of Chicago and, of course, her dear old undergraduate alma mater, Loyola University. Loyola University? Wait a minute. That sounds like it might be a university founded by people who believe in that zombie god who said... If you've done it under the least, not done it under the least of these, off to the lake of fire that was prepared for eternity for the devil and all his angels. That Loyola? That Loyola. And by the way, just because I know you'll love it when I mention this, she serves on the board of Chicago's Lyric Opera. She got a bachelor's of business administration degree from Loyola and then an MBA from the U of Chicago. I love the arts. And I want there to be a Lyric Opera of Chicago. I really do. But Lyric Opera of Chicago needs to get its board together in a goddamned hurry and vote her ass off of it. Because I don't care if it's Pagliacci or Manon Lascaux or Madame Butterfly or the Magic Flute. Nothing needs to be mounted at Chicago's Lyric Opera that has the blood and misery-soaked money from the filthy altar of Mammon that Mary Tolan gives it. Maybe there'll be a little belt tightening involved, but you know what, Lyric Opera of Chicago? Find every penny she's ever given and give her a check back for it and say, no thank you, you vengeful, hate-filled virago harpy. Bye now. So, what an interesting little first-hand experience I had with the healthcare system to couple with this more third-person understanding of healthcare in America today. Take this to heart. This is America, as the Repiglicans, as the so-called conservatives, as the evangelical Christians want it to be, where people are tormented for money before they are ever allowed to see a physician to deal with them and their broken leg, or their kids' need for tubes in their ears, or to diagnose that lump in granny's breast. This is the America that the right wing loves and says is the best country on earth. Where a millionaire says she exists on the margins. Ron and Raleigh writing to say, the margins?
Bob, she could only afford one pair of Jimmy Choo's, and she had to leave the Manolo Blahniks on the shelf. Poor thing. Darlene writing in says, this woman is full of shit. You said her name was Mary? She's probably a Catholic, named after the Virgin Mary, who was all good. And then, a few minutes later, also from Darlene, aha! Loyola! The Jesuits! We're getting warmer! Oh, warmer indeed, Darlene. Warmer indeed. David in Tennessee noting, Bob, subject line, funeral directors, Bob, this is the extension of the undertaker's advantage over to the ER. In the way back, no family would skimp on Mama's casket, and now that position of power is translated over to that ER moment. Yeah, they're just pushing it, pushing the time envelope back a little bit, aren't they, David? Greg writing in, subject line, stand your gown? In reference to over-aggressive debt collectors, do we need stand your gown legislation? Yeah, see, we're the liberals. We're the nice people. We won't do that kind of thing. But, oh yeah, you, my checkbook and my card? Yeah, come with me. Two walk in, you know, to the parking garage. Only one comes out. Phase 5, Robert from Australia says, Bob, what I'm hearing is shocking. Subject line, by the way. They really can't do that here. Bob, what I'm hearing is shocking. And I hate the meaningless corpse speak she is using. Private health insurance cannot behave like that in Australia because we have Medicare and because the people would probably burn down corporate headquarters if they found out. Could you send a few Aussies over here, Robert, just to teach the American people how to quit being sheeple and actually get pissed off at the Mary Tolans of the world and make her just brown up her undies once in a while out of sheer fear of the people that she is tormenting. This woman shouldn't be able to go to sleep at night without wondering what would happen if one of the people that she has had tormented, perhaps to death, or their family, should find out who she is and what she does. Randy noting, you seem to be reasoning perfectly fine, Bob, aside from your other health issues. Well, thanks for the affirmation, Randy. Wow, what a filibobster. My apologies, but I just felt like every last bit of this had to get said. Oh, and by the way, just one last thing, and we'll open the lines for the remainder of the program. One last thing. Now, what I've been dealing with for the last 4 years, and this, you remember a few weeks ago when Cheney got his new heart? You reckon there was an accretive worm there? Mary, my boss Mary would like to ask if you brought your checkbook with you, or does the old one over here, the evil one? Yeah, I know he carries a little pouch of soil from the home planet in his wallet, but does he also carry a credit card? Could we get a credit card payment up front, Mary? No, I don't think so. But you remember how I got pissed off about his new heart when I was thinking about the, you know, and I told you the story about my dad and his relationship with his youngest granddaughter, Doodle, and how infuriating it was to see a godforsaken draft dodger like Dick Cheney getting a new heart while some mother or father out there, maybe 38, 39, 40 years old, desperately in need of a heart, went on to their grave so that Cheney could live. This is one of those moments. Because I've been dealing for the last 4 years with what people have told me was pancreatitis, but turns out not to have been, and turns out to have actually been, as noted in the last hour and 52 minutes, have been just a rotten gallbladder. And laying in the hospital in a drug-induced stupor, but in such a drug, in one of those the kinds of drug-induced stupors where you're able to think things inside your head, it's just trying to get them out into the world, is sort of like this. You know, there's nothing like downers to make you feel slower, rounder, dumber. Well, I thought back to the year 2004. I was on air at the at a radio station, at one of the lowest rated radio stations in the fifth smallest radio market in America, Beckley, West Virginia. I was on air when then Attorney General Crisco John Ashcroft, you remember John Ashcroft, he was a fundamentalist who was anointed with Crisco cooking oil and took it upon himself to make sure that no calico cats crossed his path, and that that filthy, naked statue of Lady Justice with the great big aluminum titties was covered up with a curtain. That John Ashcroft. I remember the story of him being rushed to George Washington Hospital's emergency room and being treated for what was then deemed pancreatitis, but lo and behold, later on, they did surgery on him to what? Yeah, remove his gallbladder. Had the best health care in the world. Really. Not like what us proles get. You know, because us proles paid for his. But I was reminded as I laid there in my opiate stupor, and was thinking about how, because this is the way my little mind works, how I was glad that I didn't have the login for the Wi-Fi, lest I be tempted to use my little papaya app on the iPhone to log into the White Rose servers and just the stream of consciousness. Into the ether. Or into the series of tubes. And I remember thinking very slowly, I'm not really competent to say anything right now. And that's what made me think of Crisco John Ashcroft. Because I remember when then White House counsel Alberto Torquemada Gonzalez, who was White House counsel at the time, he had not yet been nominated to replace Crisco Boy Ashcroft. Andy Card, White House counsel and chief of staff, White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, and Andy Card, chief of staff, went zooming off to Ashcroft's hospital room, where the man was in profound pain, and I mean profound, and drugged out of his mind to get him to sign off on a reauthorization of the illegal spying that the Bush administration was doing with American citizens, contrary to every last tenet that remained in the Constitution. Assistant Attorney General James Comey also went roaring over and instructed the FBI agents not to throw him out of the Attorney General's room, even if Card and Gonzalez demanded it. Because he knew that Gonzalez and Card were such slimy, slippery, revolting, un-American, anti-constitutional filth that they would try to take advantage of the Attorney General's debilitated state in order to reauthorize that tap dance routine that the Bush administration was doing on the Constitution. The Washington Post writing of James Comey's account described it as Bush administration lawlessness so shocking it would have been unbelievable coming from a less reputable source. But it still wasn't shocking enough to merit impeachment, even though it should have been. Ashcroft, barely conscious, actually still rejected Card and Gonzalez. They tried to twist the screws on Crisco John Ashcroft, and Ashcroft lifted his head off the pillow and in very strong terms expressed his view of the matter, rich in both substance and fact, according to Comey. Then he laid his head back on the pillow and said to Card and Gonzalez, "But that doesn't matter, because I'm not the Attorney General," and then pointed to Mr. Comey. Neither of the two men, Card nor Gonzalez, even acknowledged Comey's presence, but merely turned and walked out of the room. Card called Comey and demanded he come to the White House for a dressing down. Comey said he wouldn't do it without a witness because of the conduct he had witnessed. Andy Card said, "What conduct? We were just there to wish him well." They went on and tried to reauthorize the program without a signature from the Department of Justice that would attest its legality, because the Department of Justice was actually saying it wasn't. They only backed off when most of the senior officials of the Department of Justice said they would quit. Now, what does this have to do with accretive? Well, they are both the Bush administration and this Mary Tolan harpy from accretive are cut from the same cloth. A cloth that says government is of no consequence, laws are of no consequence if they are getting in the way of authoritarian or profit-driven desires, if they are getting in the way of some manifestation of greed, and they will stop at nothing to get their way. That is the America we live in. It was 2004 when Gonzalez and Card did their dirty deed. But what Ms. Tolan has been doing, she and her army of vermin, has been going on for years. And it must be stopped. And the only way we can stop it is with some form of effective government. Jan, writing in, says, "I find what you're saying so depressing. Things like this should not happen in a so-called civilized country. Regards." No, they shouldn't. And that is why I maintain that the United States of America no longer has the right to refer to itself as civilized. So it's time for a break. Light up the phones, 877-443-2366, 877-443-2366.
the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be back.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Man, I never get tired of that hour three intro. Listen to that guitar. 8 minutes past the hour. This is a Wednesday edition of The Horn. It is the 25th day of April, the cruelest month, as T.S. Eliot noted, of 2012. And let us, let me just address this real quick. Randy says, time for an on-air funding appeal. Looks like you're going to need it. I won't do that, Randy. I won't do that. It would be improper to do so, especially since I have no idea what it's going to cost. And B, we raise funds to keep the horn on the air. So I don't know. I don't know. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Hey, so, what do you have to get this surgery within the next 6 weeks, or?
The guy looked at me and said, the sooner the better. He said, gallbladders don't get better.
And, I mean, they didn't touch on, you know, the cost or anything when you were talking about it, or?
No. He said, schedule an appointment with me. We've got to do another test, and then we'll know for sure. But he said, I bet you money. He said, based on the way that little miniature MRI, he said, you've got a dead gallbladder inside you.
Well, yeah, I mean, are there some services that you qualify for in the state, or?
No. I'm too rich.
And so what, now you just have to, pretend that it's going to eventually happen? I mean, you know, I don't know. It just is so disturbing. I don't know. I don't really know what to say.
Believe me when I say it, yes, it's disturbing. And I don't know what to say either, frankly, except to say that I am in the same boat with millions of other Americans who have been left to hope against hope, you know, and my condition is not nearly as dire as ever so many more, but to just hope against hope that something happens that makes it possible, or that, you know, I don't know, make payments, like I said, me and my heirs and assigns forever, to make this happen.
But is this the sort of service that can be provided for beforehand, and then they just sort of stick you with the debt?
That's kind of what I'm hoping to find out. With any luck at all, I'll find that out early next week.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear about that, that you have that ailment, but, you know, I'm equally disturbed and sorry about, you know, how just inaccessible it all becomes, you know? It's just like some sort of nightmare. And that story you were talking about, that company is, you know, it's a private equity fund, you know, the debt collecting company. It's a private equity fund, you know, like much like.
But they're public. But they're publicly traded.
Yeah, and they were talking about the managers of these people was saying, yeah, you know, we need to make sure we hit up pregnant women in labor too, because we're missing out on a good chunk there.
Yeah, that's a good dollar.
But this is so. This is, you know, the byproduct of having a law that states that you have to give people treatment, but there's no funds to pay for that mandate, much like we're looking at with Obamacare if they strike down the mandate.
Right. And
so, and this is sort of, you know, this is the end result of this system that we have where hospitals are doing this. It's so disgusting and so predictable, but the horror story that they've, you know, the way this all came out was because some idiot employee got his laptop stolen.
Yeah.
You know? Not to mention...
Yeah,
so,
thank heavens for whoever that little thief was.
Yeah, but it's so disturbing that they have people's HIV status and Social Security and all sorts of, you know, what used to be... I say used to be because it seems to be gone.
Well, right. Otherwise, how could Mary Tolan sit there talking to that smarmy colleague of hers on that darkened stage with that white postmodern furniture and say, we have the algorithms now that can tell you which ones will be a drain on the system?
Well, now, this is, to me, as you said, I don't really understand, you know, how cowed and pacified, you know, our society is. You know, it's incredible because the fact that people can't separate, oh, I need to get an iPad from, oh my God, I need to have health care, is so beyond the pale. This isn't a public exercise in public choice theory here. You know what I mean? And this is how everything is being played, you know, from birth to death. Everything is consumer public choice, and there's no more public good. If healthcare isn't a public good, I don't know what is. So bizarre.
If I lived in the Chicago area, where of course accretive, isn't that just a disgusting name?
Yeah, the name. I was laughing at the name, thinking, oh my God, this is, you know, it's just all around horrifying. In every aspect, yeah.
Well, if I lived anywhere near Chicago where they're headquartered, I'd be online trying to find Occupy, and suggesting that there needs to be a full scale Occupy accretive, that the place needs to be ringed with people, calling that awful woman out, and every single human being that works for that vile company. And just pointing at them and making them ashamed to be associated with the conduct with which they are associated. I mean,
well,
the sterility of the language that she used.
No, I mean, it's too much. That's what I'm saying. She's talking as if she's dealing in a market of anything.
Pork bellies, wheat futures.
Anything but what it is, which makes it just horrifying. And did you hear about, moving on to the more health horrors, or where decency meets sociopathic behavior. I heard about this woman who thought it would be okay to donate a kidney to her boss.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
The reason why I say decency, because, you know, I can imagine that someone, you know, forgive me, I say naive, because there ain't no way in hell ever I would ever consider doing something like that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, if it ain't my kid or my wife.
Right. There's no way. But I'm not going to dismiss her, the goodness.
Act of common decency.
Right.
So yeah, this is a woman in New York who went to work for a company that owns like 50 car dealerships, right? Is that it?
Yeah, Long Island.
And she was groomed by this awful woman who was talking about how she'd die if she didn't receive a kidney. She was groomed by this woman until the woman finally said, well, I'll give you one of mine. I got two. And even though she wasn't a match for the woman, she was directed to a kidney bank. This was fascinating.
Yeah, to bump up.
She gave the kidney to the kidney bank so somebody else could buy it. And then the woman was bumped up the list and got a kidney of her own as a result. And then they turned around and fired her because she was sick from the surgery she had from having the kidney removed.
No, and also, even before she did that, my first question was, you know, the woman didn't have any idea of, she didn't realize the kind of side effects that would be happening to her. And I'm like, where is this woman's support system? You see what I'm saying?
Where was the informed consent?
Well, it's too big of a move to make not to have been told of the possible downside to giving up an organ. You see what I'm saying? I'm just, this story just did my head in on so many levels. You know, it's like, you know, you know, you want to be able to sort of, you know, possibly do these good gestures, but this society is too scary. It's not accommodating that sort of stuff anymore. It's just kind of the fact that she just got turned out and destroyed after such a amazing act speaks volumes about where we at, man.
Well, and where, you know, where we are is the, it's we, aren't we in, aren't we in the aren't we in like the terminal, doesn't, don't stories like this make it abundantly clear, Sandra, that we are in the terminal end stages of free market capitalism?
Well, it's just so
when capitalism has run out of things to capitalize to the point that they have commoditized people's agony, then, you know, really, I mean, that's the road sign that says the freeway ends 0.5 miles.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, it definitely has end stages about it. I mean, it's kind of like, it's just sort of, you know, not a suicidal state, you know, participatory fascism. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of ways of kind of, calling what our system is becoming or has become. I mean, I don't know. I don't really know. But that story there really did my head in. I just thought, oh, my God.
Well,
you know?
the whole thing, there's, I mean, Jesus, I thought back to those weirdos up on Capitol Hill, like I said, you know, during the Affordable Care Act debates. You know, the guy that said he hated Canada and Canada has universal health care and Canada can't raise much food. Ferg called him the Snapple guy because he made about as much sense as the words under a Snapple lid. The woman with the hastily corrected teabagger sign about how Obama is taking us to Marxism because people can go to the doctor. On, and I mean, they were there and you know, if this thing is upheld, will we comply? No. You know, that's the front end of treason talk.
I mean, no, but when you demolish, and I mean, this is it's a slow and really ugly process to watch because the U.S., you know, sort of had the largest middle class in the history of the world. You know what I mean? So to see it all just kind of being decimated is you know, it's shocking. And all I do now, I just tell people, well, you know, one in two people are either in poverty or near poverty. No one can understand it. They can't wrap their head around it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They don't believe that stat. It's a U.S. Census stat. You can look it up if you want to open your damn eyes. See, people can't understand. They can't see just how dire shit is. Because to me, if you have 170 million people in poverty or near, the middle class is effectively kind of gone. Because that's...
Yeah, not leaving, gone.
Yeah, that's a problem. And now you have, and the political response to that problem is equally as horrific in the guise of Eric Cantor. He wants to tax that lot now. Our lot.
Yeah, because we're not, you know, it's not that the billionaires aren't paying enough.
No,
you and I aren't.
Skin in the game. That's his exact wording. Skin
yeah.
in the game. So, you know, while the Versailles on the Potomac goes on, you got stats like that, you know, which is mind-blowing. And all sort of public, the commons being just privatized, you know, like a
into oblivion.
Like a rainforest being destroyed, you know, it's just rapid.
Clear. Well, yeah, this is the economic form of clear cutting.
Yeah, no, it's bad. I mean,
and ecologically, you know, when you clear cut, everything washes away. Everything.
Well,
and you know, add to that what you said, you know, about the disappearing middle class. Nature abhors a vacuum, Sandra. What how What political nature, what economic nature fills that vacuum when the middle class is just finished?
Yeah, I don't, you know, well, it's, you know, the models are abundant in history, unfortunately. And, you know, I get back to my whole idea that, you know, the New Deal was the exception and not the rule. You know what I mean? So we're just sort of going back to default mode, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
Now, and also we seem to be hitting, you know, if you want to use more historical analogies, we seem to be not in our Great Depression, but in that depression in the, that I think it was from like 1870 to...
Yeah, the late 19th century one.
Right, the long depression.
Wasn't that called the malaise or something? There was a name for it.
And this is what I'm reading with economists are starting to view this that we're in now, which is so frightening because basically that was like 20 years of panics and a little bit of growth, then recession. You know what I'm saying? It was horrifying. It was not good. I mean, it was just sort of, and the response, you know, I don't really know what, you know, Obama, I don't know what the hell he can do with it. I mean, this is way, way big. And he
the other side are such a bunch of intransigent asses that he's even having to fight uphill just to keep the student loan interest rate from doubling.
Oh, I know. And they're trying to throw it back at him saying, well, the reason why it has to double is because of Obamacare. I almost fell out of my seat listening to that gibberish.
It is...
Well, but the thing is, Obama should be being kept up at night with this shit in Europe. That's what's freaking me out.
Well, I'm wondering if maybe he isn't. I mean, did you see the appearance, and the right wing's having a hissy about this too. His appearance on Jimmy Fallon.
Oh, what the slow jamming?
Yeah, slow jamming the news.
That's because them freaks couldn't even. What was the comment I saw? They said that Mitt Romney would be some on Leno doing the bossa nova on the news or something crazy. They can't handle Obama's coolness and what the hell he can do because he's a person of color in this society, and that kind of shit works fantastic.
Oh, yeah, over at Radio Rwanda, that attack blonde, what's her name, Gretchen Carlson?
Yeah.
Oh, she done had a plum hissy. Is this the depth to which we have sunk in America that our presidents are now slow jamming the news?
I'll say a couple of words to her. Sock it to me.
Yeah, there you go.
You know,
sock it to me.
Give me a damn break from that bullshit.
Oh, that is a perfect state save, Sandra. You know, Richard Nixon on Laugh-In.
Good Lord. Come on now. And,
But my point was, if you look at the... And, you know, I often view things through the filter of my father's eyes. We've talked about all that. And I looked at Obama when he walked out on stage. My dad used to always say that Republican presidents never age in office, whereas Democratic presidents look like they age about twice as fast. And... You know, he's not. We're roughly the same age. Barack Obama is beginning to look like an old black man.
Yeah,
you
no,
know, he's getting that. Know. He's getting that frost in the hair. You know what I mean?
All you need to do is to get some sort of horn rim glasses, and that'll be it for him.
Well, I'm just afraid I'm going to tune in one day, and he's going to look like Huey's grandpa from Boondocks.
Yeah, no. Because I think he's only 50 or 51. You know, he's not.
Yeah, but Jimmy Carter was a relatively young man when he entered office, and he was old when he left. There's lots of examples. Bill Clinton got done and immediately had his heart go. Meanwhile, Ronnie Reagan looks like he's 50 years old when he leaves. When he leaves talking to his oatmeal at the end of the 80s.
Oh, yeah, and I guess Bush is back in his sundown city living nice, ain't he?
Yeah.
Jesus. No. I don't know if people know what sundown
cities are. No, go help.
Well, it's just you know, back in the day, there was areas that were sort of when the black maids and whatnot finished taking care of all the whiteys, they gotta get out of town before the sun sets.
Yeah, don't let the sun set on you here.
And Highland, whatever in Texas where the Bushes live, you know, was one of those places.
Yeah.
Just a little fun fact for people out there.
Yeah, Lupe got to get on down the road and get on the bus.
Right. So anyway, I'm sure Bush is looking mighty fine, even though he can't step off.
Well, Jesus, Dick Cheney's 71 years old. He's got some 12-year-old's heart, and he's out doing.
No. I mean, so I definitely, I don't know what Obama is going to do outside of presiding over the decline. I mean, he's doing a great impression of Claudius. I mean, I don't know. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, I'm thinking more Marcus Aurelius.
Oh, well, okay.
Yeah, because that's a little further down the road of decline.
Yeah, I guess. I was just sort of thinking of that because, Claudius was fairly thoughtful, but he had his little war in Britain, and he had to do the right thing to keep the right people sweet, and he knew what the hell to do.
Well, I just think of Marcus Aurelius trying to hold the German frontier against the barbarian hordes.
Oh, so you're saying we're way down the line.
Oh, yeah, we're a lot further into the game than we think we are.
I think that the sort of,
Because, when you talk about the rise of the national security state, that's Harry Truman, and Harry Truman, gladly ceded power. So, Eisenhower is our Augustus. If you want to play Roman history, he's not so much a Caesar as he is. John Kennedy is our Germanicus. Germanicus was the brilliant Roman slated to follow, I believe, Tiberius, who was quietly poisoned so as to keep him out of the succession so that we could get Caligula instead.
Right, yes.
Yeah, and Claudius follows Caligula, and Nero follows Claudius. I think you could argue that Dim Sun W was probably our Nero.
Yeah, I was about to say. I mean, that definitely works in reverse on that.
You know, especially in light of the fact that Nero liked to play his lyre. And we have that eponymous photo of Bush during Katrina playing his upside-down guitar and getting a G chord wrong.
Oh, God. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not even sure if...
But I think maybe historians somewhere down the road, Sandra, might come up with some sort of political law that says the more technologically advanced the empire, the quicker its demise.
Well... yeah, I mean, if he's one term, though, I'm going to have to move us back to, the 19th century Buchanan. I'm going to have to go with that one with Mr. Obama. But let's hope.
Well, you talk about Buchanan, and, of course, this country was nothing but conflict by the end of the Buchanan presidency. A bunch of the teabagging bigots were outside the Supreme Court today protesting in support of SB 1070. I saw a photograph of one particular button being worn by a bagger. You're going to love what it said, Sandra. Don't blame me. I voted for the American.
Oh, God. Well, I don't know. I'm scared of the Supreme Court, though. It's like, oh, okay, so we're able to be stripped for no reason. Now we're going to codify racial profiling.
Yeah.
I'm just listening to what they're kind of speculating, and it sounds like they want to uphold, some of that law. Now, what happened to the idea that the federal government is in charge of immigration? Is that just going to be tossed out?
Well, did you read that story in the last few days about the 20 lewd Chinese women case?
Oh, no, God, I missed that.
That's 1870 or so, and this California... This little low-level California bureaucrat was invested by California law with the power to board ships and demand bonds from the captain of the ship for lewd women. Lewd women were, of course, defined as being Asian women who wore flowered print clothing. And it went to the Supreme, it went to the, first it went to the district court, or the state court level or whatever. They upheld his power to do so. But eventually it got to the Supreme Court, and it's a very, very seminal case because the Supreme Court said no. No, you can't invest the states with the power to declare what national immigration policy shall be, because, you know, it happens that California had ports, you know, in this case San Francisco, ports that bring immigrants in who go all over the country, and therefore states cannot declare how immigrants will be treated, what sort of horrors they will be subjected to. This is a national issue, and it's, you know, really clear and quite precedent-setting.
That's the case law, and what? That would be undone behind this decision?
Well, if they uphold 1070, and in the arguments, you know, it's kind of like the Affordable Care Act arguments, they made these grumbly noises from the bench that made it sound like they were all in favor of some of the worst aspects of SB 1070. They would, you know, it would be another case of Alito and Roberts in particular perjuring themselves by their actions, you know, the balls and strikes and we're going to honor stare decisis and all of that stuff, because they would effectively have to overturn that case and a number of others in order to uphold SB 1070. Because there is nothing even remotely constitutional about it, nor is there even anything remotely constitutional about, you know, what Alabama did or Georgia did or any of these other laws that were crafted by this right-wing bigot from Kansas with like ties to Russell Pierce, who of course has ties to Nazis. It's all there.
Yeah, but the thing is, the irony is that, I mean, you know, the immigration as far as Mexicans are concerned has stopped. Have you heard that?
Yeah, it hasn't just stopped. It may be going backwards.
In reverse.
But the thing is, that will be used by these bigots as saying, well, see, it works.
It's already being used in that capacity. But
yeah.
what it does signify, us people who give, you know, serious thought, is that the economy, the economic situation worldwide and domestically is just in an absolute have immigration, which is an engine of your, you know, economy, come to a standstill. That's a big problem to me, not because of how malfunction and dysfunctional, you know, our economic system is now.
I loved one of the Think Progress has a compendium of things that were said outside the Supreme Court today by baggers and bigots and the like. Go back to your third world armpit if you don't like it. Those pointing to a Latino protester, another bagger, birther, booger eater said, those people over there are trespassing.
Well, and then you just go ahead and beat them to death and have it recorded by passerbys.
Yeah, because that happened.
You know, did you hear about that
before? Yeah, you mean the border agents who beat, you know, a Mexican to death on camera?
And a Mexican with four or five American children and a wife left to twist in the wind here with no answer from the government. Fuck you very much. Go away. It's an incredible story. I wish I could remember the man's name, but it's like the Rodney King of that situation. You know, it's bad. It's bad. Real bad.
Right. Exactly.
You know. So I don't know. It's not going to get. And the thing about it's really disturbing is it's not going to get much play because the propaganda has done a bang up job of dehumanizing undocumented people. It's horrifying. So, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if they'll get any answers at all. But anyway, listen, you know, I'm like depressed myself, so I'll let you go. I hope you know, please keep us informed about what's happening with you, because that's a scary thing. I don't really know what to say or just have some good thoughts. I don't know. I really hope
I appreciate it, Sandra.
I hope you get a pass to get what you need done.
Me too. I mean, I've never looked forward to surgery.
But it was made abundantly clear to me that that's really the only thing that presents as a viable solution to this problem.
And it sounds like the quality of your life would improve immensely. Not to mention, this is my own, like, button in on your life. It'd give you the chance to put down the cigarettes, man, if you have to go through all that.
Yeah, you know what? I'm already I'm working toward that. I am actually the owner of a box of nicotine gum.
Yeah, listen, no, and coming from someone who used to smoke, so I don't want to have to be thinking, you know, otherwise out there. I smoked for years and I was able to stop, so I know exactly how horrific it is.
Thank you. Thank you. You're listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.
Thank you.